Welcome. This is William Evans, and we're shifting gears. Our guest today, again, is Stuart Brown. This is our second summer conversation with Stuart, the founder of the National Institute for Play. Welcome, Stuart.
Glad to be here, Will.
In our last conversation, you spoke about the value of unstructured play and the consequences of play deprivation. Today, I'd like to start by asking you to tell us more about two topics you were discussing at the end of our earlier conversation. First, you spoke about the enjoyment you get teaching parents of young children how to begin to notice and cultivate an infant's innate playfulness.
It's really fun to do so because most parents don't think about this as a part of their observing parentage. But, for example, if you take a 3 to 6 month old infant that's, let's say they're dry and well fed, and they're lying on, he or she is lying on a blanket, and both parents are babbling back and forth to this sweet little kid, and the kid looks up with a social smile and smiles at the parent, and they start their baby talk. But also, adjacent to this little baby is, let's say, a bright colored handkerchief. And so the little baby would be looking up naturally at the parents and smiling and enjoying that, but then glance off at the handkerchief. And if there is a sudden burst of glee at the grabbing or the looking at the handkerchief, that is as exuberant as the glee was with the parent-child looking at each other, that's a clue that that child really is enchanted, and their play nature may well be geared more toward objects and colors than specifically to social cues. And if that parent then is being instructed that that's kind of a watch for the gleeful moment, the spontaneous glee that comes from within the child spontaneously, that's not necessarily triggered by the adults, watch that and look at that and nourish it. Because if it's object enchantment, gleeful involvement with a toy or with a highly colored object, and that though there is preferential aspects of the choice of the infant for objects over, let's say, social or physical or musical stimuli, then that deep intrinsic play motivation is a cue to probably the innate talent of the child. And when you begin to inform parents about this, that they should look for the joyfulness and look for the spontaneity that is deep within their own child, there often is within that a cementing of the parent-child bond and a more joyful, anxiety-free kind of interaction that is a hallmark to, I think, more fun with parenting. And let's say if the parents themselves are not as freely playful as they might once have been, instructing the parent to really allow what in them produces the glee, produces a joy, so that they really are freely playful themselves, is a really nice kind of entree into this element of parenting. And by the way, it's pretty obvious when little kids are growing up, from whether they're 3 months old or 18 months old, they're players primarily. That's who they are and what they are.
Remembering the joy of play.
You got it.
Well, we could use massive doses of that.
And how, all of it.
All ages.
All ages through the whole life cycle. It's there in all of us through our whole lifetime, a little more pure and evident when you're 3 to 6 months old and given a series of choices, because then it's kind of pure play from within you. And when we get older, it gets a little more often encultured and cluttered.
But if we're able to maintain that link, is there anything you want to tell us about old people? I mean, the very elderly who remain joyful?
Well, I think if you look at the whole developmental trajectory of any human life from birth to death, there is within that life, if you know other things being equal, the capacity and the unique personality of each of us to engage in play, or at least to get into, quote, states of play. And whether you are a 3-month-old or a 10-year-old, a 50-year-old, or someone who's even in a dementia unit, if you can access that playful feeling, playful affect, the playful state, your mood, your general reaction to stress, and your sense of fulfillment is going to be improved.
The other thing you spoke about in our last conversation was Nobel Prize winners and how their playfulness is their work. And I'd love to hear you say more about that, because when I get into the zone of playing with what I'm doing, time is lost. It disappears.
Well, that's one of the definitions of play, is to suddenly experience yourself outside of time. And that's, you know, if you're in that zone and outside of time, chances are the state that you are in is what I would say is a pure, true, authentic play state. But the Nobel laureates were, for me, a fascinating group. And probably while I was a medical student observing a future Nobel laureate, we, of course, didn't know he was going to be that at the time, and observing him in his research initially in the anatomy and then the physiology labs at Baylor College of Medicine, his name was Roger Guillemin. You certainly, since you went to Baylor, you remember him.
Right.
And I was a prosector in the anatomy lab, and he was dissecting brains, looking for certain possibilities. And he would just absolutely find himself laughing and full of himself while he was doing his research. And I do vividly remember that one night we asked him, well, what are you doing, Roger? He said, well, I keep finding very large veins in the posterior pituitary area of the brain, and they're too big to be explained by the normal physiology expected in that area of the brain. So something else must be going on. These veins must be carrying a substance. Well, 20 years later, he discovered the substances after a lot of intricate research, and of course, these were the releasing factors for hormones that came out of the hypothalamus into the pituitary, posterior pituitary, for which he got the Nobel Prize. But he was joyful in his initial exploration. Well, segue another 30 years or more. Roger lives in La Jolla. I live in La Jolla. He's at the Salk Institute. He invites me over one night to his laboratory at the Salk Institute. And here is this highly intricate, very, very detailed biochemical array of where he's extracting small chain proteins which are involved in as releasing factors. And he's just dancing up and down while he's describing all the glassware and the various things. And I, by then, was more interested and more formally involved in play, and began to realize that this guy, his work was his play.
Yes.
And there, you know, I did have the opportunity in doing some other creative work with the British Broadcasting Company and PBS on a series called Soul of the Universe, in which we interviewed a series of Nobel laureates, and the majority of them, though they weren't necessarily French dancers like Roger Guillemin, were also absolutely enchanted and joyful in their, quote, work. The work and play were indistinguishable.
Wow. So today, the challenges confronting us are absolutely mythic. What did you learn from your friendship with Joseph Campbell about play, authentic identity, and mythic challenges?
Well, we've only got a half hour. 10 years with Joseph Campbell as a close associate and creating some programs through his work was a monumental experience for me and a great learning experience. So there's no singular sentence that I can give you. But Joseph Campbell really was able to, I think, hone in on the necessity for an inner narrative that you believe, which gives you a sense of direction and purpose, which is, as he termed, your believed truth, which is your mythology, your personal mythology. And that when that personal mythology is in harmony with your temperament, with your culture, with the science of the day, with the surroundings, that you tend then to be empowered and comfortable in your own skin through the trajectory of your life. And he said, you know, most of those lives that are in such sync are heroic. And the, as you know, he wrote a book early in his life called The Hero with a Thousand Faces, and then really elaborated on that with much of his scholarly writing. So that if I were to take the Joseph Campbell wisdom and take a look at the trajectories that I have learned about through the many play reviews I've done, and begin to say, how do these things go together? When I watch the development of a personal narrative that is authentic from within, kind of what I talked about, the glee from the little infant, and see that authentic narrative begin to make sense of the world for a child, for example, as they're struggling to make the big world make sense to their imagination and other things, they begin to establish a storyline that is either healthy, intrinsically motivated from within themselves, or is forced on them by the culture, by parents, by teachers, by religion that don't make good sense to them necessarily. And when their inner narrative is not a product of their own direct play experience, or when they have play deficits, then the health of their mythology, the health of their personal narrative, is compromised and tends to persist throughout their life. And, of course, this is an oversimplification and pretty complicated stuff, but Campbell's background and scholarship, my own involvement with neuroscience and with play, have really come together to make better and better sense to me, and also make sense of a lot of the dissonance that we see culturally and interpersonally, because the inner narrative is not authentic, it's contrived. The outer world doesn't quite fit the inner narrative, and that dissonance creates inner havoc and often depression and other kinds of defenses. So that's Campbell's background, and I would say the things that have dropped into my lap through research on play make eminent sense to me for all humans.
Well, it makes sense to me too, and the distraction and disengagement from that critical early time of beginning to play with authentic identity and discovery of who we are is absolutely critical, or we don't step into the great need of the world with who we are and the gifts we came with.
Couldn't agree with you more. I think the sense of a longing for personal meaning and personal authenticity, for a lot of people, they think this has to be really deep, serious exploration. And yet, to my way of thinking, following your play bliss gives you guidance to develop just that purpose and that meaning and that authenticity. And when it is missed, it isn't that's the only thing in your life, but it is a central key to keeping mood and the interior physiology and the outside world in some kind of balance. And without it, it is not going to be balanced.
This is William Evans. You're listening to Shifting Gears, and we're speaking with Stuart Brown about play. Yeah, I watched a mythic shift in the local high school a few years ago, and I got into a situation where I didn't have the answer for my own culture, so I called an indigenous friend from the Haida culture, Woody Morrison, up in Vancouver. And he said to me, tell the students this is not the first time humanity has faced a calamity. It's happened many times before, and we observe, and our history relates many times, that people who cooperate are more likely to survive. And when I gave that to the students, that was the bridge I needed to work with them with identity and basically balancing human physiology to the point where they could be functional again. And I watched a huge shift. So I know it can happen quickly, but it's so challenging in our time and in our culture because the electronic distractions are almost overwhelming in pulling external focus on a young person.
Very well said. You know, the challenge to balance a digital and virtual world with the real external world and with the necessity for some kind of physiology that makes sense to you in your inner world, that's tough. And my heart goes out to a lot of kids who are celebrity-oriented or who are screen-addicted or screen-at-least habituated, where some of their own joyfulness is either dopamine hits from a quick video game or it doesn't happen. So it's what you said is very, very valid. Good for you that you got into a service orientation where you could help those kids.
Well, over the years, I'm reminded of what you've said to me a number of times, and that is play is the glue that holds together a cooperative culture.
It really is. I think the essence of being able to tolerate people that aren't necessarily your own temperament or your own values, but having empathy for them, being able to tolerate them, having some humor about the differences, allows multiple talents within a community to stay together and belong. And without the play and without the humor and without the anticipation that something new is going to come from the mix, we don't get along well with each other. And I think what we've seen in our political and congressional and who knows in the international scene, it seems an oversimplification for a lot of people to incorporate play into the developmental life of each of those cultures. And yet, from my standpoint, unless we do, the ability to belong, to establish communities, to have cooperation, to find empathy when there are differences is going to be much harder to come by.
Yeah, and I've heard you also tell me non-players don't survive.
Well, they don't in the animal world, that's for sure.
And humans who are able to play and adapt develop life-sustaining skills and capabilities that can be life-saving.
Correct.
During my visits with the Waitaha Nation and indigenous people in New Zealand and very ancient people, I've been able to observe their children at play in nature. And there's this continuing flow of joy and an absence of crying and fighting. And this time of year, and it happened this morning, I was working in my office with the window open and I could hear children down the hill playing in the river. And I noticed, again, there was no crying, no fighting, but there was this continuous chatter, and they were talking all the time. But underlying this was just, and watching them and watching the parents just sitting on the rocks on the edge of the river watching, I wondered where their imaginations were flowing. And fortunately, these were young enough kids that they weren't into a contest.
Well, if you listen to the dialogue with kids who are reasonably safe, not over-organized by parents, and who have stimuli, as you say, of natural surroundings, they create imaginary worlds, games, individual identities that vary from person to person, age to age, and there is a sound of what I would say is it's a kind of a squealing, exploratory, curious joyfulness that seems to come naturally out of such settings. Now, of course, there's some breakdown, and occasionally, and kids of different age won't share, and I don't want to idealize things too much, but basically you get a setting like you describe along a stream or a river, a summer day, parents who are observing till the kids are safe and secure, and you watch them. They'll self-organize and develop games and fun and go to the next level of excellence in their own skills, driven by their own natural play instincts.
Tell us a little bit about what you learned in the process of doing your National Geographic issue on animals at play.
Well, left practice and decided that play was really important and didn't at that time have a sense of what is it really in terms of the evolution of not only our species but other species that love to play. It seemed to me that there was something in wild animal play that was pure and needed to be understood. And there wasn't an investigator and a scholar by the name of Bob Fagan, on Admiralty Island in southeast Alaska who had been studying bear play for then about 15 years. And he had written a book called Animal Play Behavior, which is still the gold standard of understanding animal play. So after reading that book and getting a contract with the Geographic, I got to go up and spend weeks with him observing bear play through his eyes and from a tree stand on Peck Creek, Admiralty Island, southeast of Juneau. And spending those weeks with him watching animal play and then seeing the research that he had collected over the years. He's also a mathematical, to me, genius. So he had mathematized the movements and had followed the natural history of bear play, both their survival and the amount of play they engaged in, the ages and so forth, had cataloged that. From that kind of grounding from Bob Fagan's scholarship, I began to get a sense of the breadth of play behavior, how necessary it was for the bears if they were not only going to survive, because he had been able to demonstrate that the degree and skills at play and future survival of the bears were related mathematically and otherwise. So I began to get a sense that that play, at least in the social mammals that are brown bears in that portion of the world, was phenomenally important and that he had grounded it in really solid science and scholarship. So then I was able to, with the help of the Geographic, go worldwide for a couple of years. So there's every reason to believe, and there's also evidence from anencephalic humans who are born without a cortex but who can play early on, that these instinctive circuits for play that are part of the animal world, part of our world, are survival circuits. So this is a long-winded answer to this is kind of where the Geographic work led me.
Right. So play can be transformative. And although sometimes it's inappropriately dismissed as unnecessary and trivial, it's freely available and of enormous significance. What final words do you have for us, Stuart?
Gosh, I don't, you know, I think I would say we are built by play and we are built to play.
Beautiful.
And without it, it's not much of a life.
Yeah, it's able to change me and it's able to change my relationships and circumstances.
Well, it's transformative, I think, for all of us. And even those who have lost it or who feel like their lives are so overburdened with poverty and travail, even there they can find little flickerings of play. And in so doing, their lives are going to be improved.
And we can remember it in a flash.
Mm-hmm.
And the change is immediate.
That's right.
Thank you, Stuart.
Thank you, Will, and I hope all your audience plays more.
Oh, may it be so, and may I keep playing as much as possible. This is William Evans. I've been speaking with Stuart Brown about play. This is KDNK. Thank you for listening.